club. And every night, the finest fifth musicians that ever lived, died, gather there to play. They have a gift for music, the fifth, which you should know in advance so that the contextual arena of the following anecdote makes sense once I reach its amusing conclusion. Anyway, these dead yet legendary Biff musicians create the sweetest music in the whole quintessence. On stage, however, sits a simple stool, upon which a golden clue horn rests that no musician dares play or even touch. Well, if you wait long enough and drink enough of whatever the Biff drink, again, I challenge you to talk to one of them and understand a single thing they tell you. And I mean not understand as in to know precisely what they are saying, but rather to truly comprehend what the things they are saying actually mean. The Biff legend goes on that in this club, you may see the stranger when he comes for his horn. Now, you ask, who is this, the stranger, and why should I care? Well, I shall tell you. It is, in fact, the purpose of this delightful parable-slash-joke I have chosen to share with you as an entree into our business at hand. The stranger enters this music club in heaven and approaches the stage. In reverence and respect, everyone watches in silence. The stranger picks up the horn, plays just one note, and it sounds so beautiful that everyone present weeps in an aesthetic apotheosis. It is revelatory. It is the very sound of light, of love. His single note leaves them all weeping every time, musician and drinker alike. And then this stranger, he leaves, if you can believe it, as quickly and quietly as he came. One night, the stranger comes, picks up his horn, rends the hearts of those present in twain, and exits as is his wont. So one regular, rather a newcomer compared with some of the old-timers, turns to another regular, this one an old-timer who will know, unlike the newcomer asking the question, and asks, not without a little incredulity, who is that guy, Lirin Davi? And the old-timer says, no, it is God. He only thinks he is Lirin Davi.
Davi waits for a laugh that never comes.
For you see, in Biff culture, Lirin Davi was the finest clue horn player ever to...
It is a lost cause. The scrapper opposite gives Kabi the look. It is the look that means, tiny bat-faced creature, your language sounds like a series of squeaks and chirps to me, and I have no idea what you are on about. And Kabi sees it about 17 times a day. She sighs and places a golden clue horn atop the scrapper's countertop.
Anyway, this is it. Give me 55.
This language the scrapper speaks. He haggles Kabi down to 48, which was really 3 more than Kabi dared hope to get for the tarnished piece of crap sound tube in the first place, and then displays it prominently in the window of his scrapper shop. Scrapper shops always have a clue horn in the window. They're good for business. The Mooftak and Kabi, rulers of the Kingdom of the Cantina Underground, which is a kingdom with a population of 2. By night, the Mooftak sleeps in the cavernous stone pipeways below the spaceport, below the scorching desert surface of Tatooine, below the view of the twin suns that sear the sky, relishing the lower ambient temperature and the mercy it grants his thick-furred hide. Moisture sometimes collects on the walls, which they reclaim and sell. Kabi sleeps in the tunnels because the darkness feels better on her terrible eyes. And because the Muftak sleeps there too. And where the Muftak goes, safety follows. The Muftak and Kabi, a team, squat there together in the dark, waiting for the impossible, that their luck or the heat one day will break. During business hours, the Muftak and Kabi prowl the darker, cooler cantina and harvest whatever loot they can from the drunk and damaged denizens staggering around the spaceport, rolling suckers for loose change, their numerous eyes peeled for an easy pickin', or whatever else they might pawn. Casing the tourists and transients, they'll lift from one guy, sell to another, spend the cash on a thing some other third chump somewhere wants but doesn't know how to find. Then they'll mark it up, move it along, and live like lords until the money's gone. And repeat, always, forever, ABC. Always be certain to hustle, hustle, hustle. Making a living in the Mos Eisley underworld means constant legwork, sketchy math, dubious markups, and always knowing whatever the next thing is gonna be, no matter what exactly the next thing is. It is exhausting. At Mos Eisley, everyone has side hustles. But the Muftak and Kabi, even their side hustles have side hustles. Akmina knows this, and keeps it all on the down low. Because what kind of drink-slinger would she be if she didn't? But at the same time, respect must be paid. And by respect, Akmina means rent. Not a lot, but enough that Akmina can slip a little something to Chalmun, who owns the whole place, while padding her silk-lined pockets to make the trip underground worth her while. She clears her throat. The Muftak, sleeping one off, rouses as if waking up from a mild case of light paralysis. Kabi, for her part, chirps. Kabi likes Akmina, and Akmina thinks Kabi's voice sounds like music, and so she enjoys listening to her chirp.
"First of the month, my sweet, sweet hairballs,"
she says, not without some affection, her voice resonating off the cool stone of their lair, echoing into the dark forever. The Muftak may have drunk their money away last night. Akmina has a heavy pour for friends. He might have lost the rest of his money, of their money, to the Sakaian, over a dubious hand or a levantine of cards. The Muftak can't be certain, although he is, in fact, very certain. Let us for the moment give him this feint at uncertainty, and at least a shred of dignity. One way or the other, Mayo was certainly involved in the Muftak's change of fortunes last night. Does Mayo owe him money? How does one ask a violence enthusiast like Mayo to pay up? The Muftak has many questions. Kabi chirps. The Muftak rubs his four eyes, trying to reduce the number of patient Akminas waiting for him to pay up. He scratches his head.
Oh, hang on. Where did I put it?
He clicks, hoping the pantomime buys him time. Kabi chirps. The Muftak pats himself for pockets he does not have, as he does not now wear, nor has he ever worn pants, or any article of clothing for that matter, as he lives his life trapped beneath a thick blanket of fur on an arid planet that may in fact be made, somehow, of actual, real, literal fire.
Yo,
the Muftak croaks to Kabi.
With your thunderous cavalcade of non-stop chatterboxing, shall literally murder me if you dare continue such noise. Have mercy, little friend, for inside my head is a violent, angry beast, punishing me for having good luck at the sabacc table last night.
The Muftak had very bad luck at the sabacc table last night. Yet still, Kabi chirps. And what she chirps, what she has chirped the whole time, is this.
I have some money.
and all four of the Muftak's eyes give Kabi not the look, but rather the other look. The Muftak is the only one that ever gives the other look to Kabi, probably because the Muftak is the only one that ever understands Kabi. And the other look means, I know what you are saying, but I do not know what has transpired to compel you to say such a thing. Needless to say, as, after all, this is but a silent look we exchange for that most fleeting of moments, we shall talk about it anon in more private company. Kabi sighs and digs out 45, what she got for the horn, less her handler's fee and early riser's bonus, of course, and waves it at the Muftak.
Dummy!
Where did you get that?
The Muftak clicks. Then he realizes it doesn't matter, and he doesn't really care. The Muftak takes the money from Kabi and hands it to Akmina. It is one of the only times the Muftak doesn't extract his customary protectorate surcharge for taking general care of Kabi, but he makes a note to himself to doubly compensate himself in the future. Akmina counts it. She tisks.
45? That's more than half light, friends. And with my delivery charge and filing tariffs extracted, you're short 60 at least.
She looks at them. They look at each other. They know she won't kick them out. She knows they know she won't kick them out. And probably physically she couldn't, even if she wanted. Which she doesn't. Not really. They know that she knows that they know, and she knows, and they know, and on and on. Chalman, the boss, the landlord, owner of bars, maker of drinks, and breaker of legs, needs his vig, or he'll send someone down to the tunnels to extract it the old-fashioned way. If his mood goes particularly sour that day, which, being a Wookiee in the desert, happens with great frequency, he may choose to exterminate the infestation of Muftaks and Chadra fans in his pipes. Lost income be damned. On this, at least, the Muftak and Chalman share common ground. But not enough to keep the Muftak alive. Life gets pretty cheap in Mos Eisley.
I'll get it,
the Muftak clicks. He doesn't know if Akmina understands his exact words or not. She gets the spirit of the thing, if not the details.
Tonight, sweethearts, respect must be paid. You know how it is.
She turns to go, and the sound of her footfalls echoing down the length of the tunnel pipe makes the Muftak's head throb more.
Oh, small friend, before I die, and I assure you I shall die. Today, for certain. Tonight, if I find luck. But surely, surely my time is now at hand.
The Muftak tacked.
Please, Kabi, please tell me where and how you came upon such a small fortune. Because, for the life of me, whatever little is left, whatever little it may be worth, I could have sworn you were in quite the state of financial embarrassment with regard to the liquidity of your resources. And I myself am clearly destitute as well, meaning we, my friend, shall continue our streak of very bad luck unless we find some form of windfall today. Which, I don't know, seems pretty unlikely.
But a moment ago, you said you had good luck. You said you had very good luck at the sabacc tables last night.
Kabi counters. Quoth the Muftak.
I may have misspoken.
Blame not the hustler for hustling.
I sold the crew horn of Lirian Khan.
Kabi squeaks. A light. Small, dim, but a light all the same goes off somewhere inside the Muftak's aching skull.
smallish. Forgive me if I am mistaken, but I seem to have the vaguest recollection that Mayo, who owes us both a not insignificant sum, won said horn last night from Lirin Karn himself, and in celebration drank himself to the point of irritability, and then left the table and the horn behind when it was in fact I who then took the instrument in question.
The Muftak clicks.
With the intent of converting it into funds later today in reparation of Mayo's aforementioned debt.
Indeed. And knowing the day and what was due Akmina,
Kabi says,
I relieved you of the horn while you slumbered, as you had relieved him of the horn that he had relieved from Lirin Karn, and thus made with great haste to a scrubber I knew who would be in the market for horns, especially for golden horns of Clue.
I passed out and you stole it from me,
the Muftak counters.
I find that interpretation radiantly unkind.
Counter counters the Jadrafan.
Blessed sons!
The Muftak rages, hangover draining as fear-based adrenaline floods within him, and he leaps to his feet.
Mayo will eat you for this!
No, Mayo will eat you for this. Unless he finds out it was I who actually pawned the thing. But that,
chirps the small one,
is a tomorrow problem. Our today problem is paying rent.
Kabi basks in her righteousness. And unless she's stealing his stuff, the Muftak finds that Kabi is usually right. Lirin Karn trembles with rage, fear, regret, doubt, anxiety, despair, and whatever the word is for the feeling you get when you drank so much and played so poorly at cards that you lost your father's clue horn. Which indeed is very much a feeling, and a feeling with a name, but it comes from the Bith, who tend to be the only ones that feel it, and, as you don't speak Bith anyway, its name does not matter. Trust that this feeling is proper and named and true, albeit rare in its ever being felt. Yet it is felt, more than it has ever been felt before, by Lirin Karn, the Bith, right now, in the Mos Eisley Cantina.
And you want me to find this thing for you? The Joss Poor asks the Bith.
You're a bounty hunter, aren't you? Well, I'm putting a bounty on my father's horn. I lost it to Mayo. Mayo doesn't have it. He believes that while he was in his cups, the thing was stolen from him. His solution to the problem is to scream and growl and look for something to kill. I find that business matters are better handled by businessmen.
Indeed. In fact, Mayo paid me what he swore was his last credit, to hunt whoever it was that dared steal from him in the first place. Of course, if he finds them first, he'll kill them, and thus moot the deal. But you understand.
As far as I am concerned, Karn says, the horn stopped belonging to Mayo once Mayo ceased to actually have the thing. It is, as they say, in the wind. And I want it back.
You're a businessman, you say. You were in the music business. Without a horn, there is no music. And sans music, you are sans business. How am I to know such a bounty exists? The Sakaian asks.
As a people, they are nothing if not practical.
I'm good for it. I'll make good for it, Karn says. After I can play again, one session, one gig, I'll pay you 200.
So the arrangement is, for 200... I find a 50-credit horn.
50? How dare you! Do you have any idea who my father was? Do you? Do... You don't. This horn, the legend of this... I... You...
Karn stammers on like this, but all of his protestations fall on tone-deaf Sakaian ears.
Your problem, you Sakaian, is you have no appreciation for art.
The Bith see the poetry in the mathematics of music. I see the poetry in the mathematics of money. Either way, we both can appreciate the beauty of numbers. So, 200 plus expenses. That is, as they say, music to my ears.
Get my horn. I'll get you your money.
And allow dear Furious Mayo to deal with the interlopers?
Exactly,
says Karn, as his trembling subsides.
Wait, interlopers? Plural?
Don't worry about it.
Djaspur rises from the dark little alcove table he thinks of as his regular seat and sets about the day's work. He already knows what transpired, and how, and why. He knows, or at least can make an intuitive yet accurate guess as to how this mess with the clue horn began. It isn't terribly difficult knowing the cohort that frequents his table, but as the only one without a taste for drink, Djaspur, bounty hunter, tends to be the one who sees such things first. And, if he's stealthy about it, the one who stands to profit. Most people at Mos Eisley think of the place as a port, or a bar, or a bazaar even. Liren Karn thinks of it as a stage. Djaspur knows that, more than anything else, Mos Eisley is a place of business. The Muftak staggers into the daylight of Tatooine, hating his parents a little more for birthing him into a universe where such unreasonable heat could possibly exist. His name isn't the Muftak, but rather Muftak. And as for his species, instead of being a Muftak, as most people assume, hence the addition of a definite article as a prefix, Muftak is a Tals that came from Orto Plutonia, which is really quite far from Tatooine, and being full of ice and snow and cold things could serve as a model of the desert planet's literal polar opposite. How the how Atolls came to Tatooine is another story for another time. But needless to say, neither Muftak nor any of the other regulars has ever seen another like him. At some point, Mayo, confused, as Mayo often becomes, decided Muftak the Tals was in fact just the Muftak, and it kind of stuck after a while, mostly because Muftak got tired of fighting it. The Muftak does math in his baking, roasting, broiling head, with certain reductions in surcharges, tariffs, consideration taxes, delivery codes, and gratuities. He thinks he can pull together enough to at least live to see the twin sun setting a few more times. First, he must find the smuggler, and then he must find the pig-nosed man, a human, he thinks, or the walrus-faced man, an aqualish, he knows, and whom he knows will, if the two of them are separate, know where to find the pig-nosed, probably human man. Nobody likes the pig-nosed man, except, it would seem, the walrus-faced man. Sooner or later, they'll all end up at the bar. At Mos Eisley, sooner or later, everyone ends up at the bar. So the Muftak trudges to the bar. Mayo, a fike-happy Abyssin with one eye, white mutton chops, and a giant chip on his shoulder, rages at the scrapper. The scrapper, secure behind half a meter of what has to at least be Mayo-proof shielding, yawns.
Yell and scream all you like, pal, but business is business. Someone came in and sold me the horn. I put the horn in the window. Someone came in and bought the horn. Clue horns are good for business. Everybody knows that.
But it was mine!
Mayo yells.
No,
says the scrapper.
It was mine.
Mayo thinks, as this is not his strong suit, it takes a while.
Who?
He works out the question in his mind, and the scrapper could swear he hears gears grinding.
Who bought it.
The scrapper says,
How dare you, sir? The privacy of our clientele and their business is second only to our discretion.
But as he says it, the scrapper curls his fist, two fingers up and in, two times. Pap, pap. The intergalactic symbol for 20. Mayo slides the money under the razor-thin slit beneath the shielding that separates them. Where he got it is a story for another time. And besides, it isn't his anymore.
A Sakaian, real shiny, walked in. Bought it up like he was looking for it. Didn't even haggle price. 300.
The hell you sold that thing for 300?
Mayo says. Nobody's so dumb as to believe a clue horn would sell for that much in a scrapper shop like this. Not even Mayo.
It was in that neighborhood, 300, 250, a hundo, somewhere in there.
Mayo narrows his eye.
And who sold it to you in the first place?
Once again, sir, I insist you respect the confidentiality of our customers and blah, blah, blah.
The scrapper says, again doing the little curl of his two fingers, meaning, feed me. Another 20 goes under the partition.
Some little bat weasel, I don't know, like an Ugnaught with a gland issue or something. I thought he was a real hairy kid at first.
She,
snarls Mayo.
Cobby.
Mayo mentally adds 40 to the price he'll extract from the little Chadra fan that sleeps in the tunnels below them, which again, as thinking is not his strong suit, takes a while, which only makes Mayo more mad. Which, as it happens, is Mayo's strong suit. A clue horn would make a not ridiculous cane, thinks DeJospoor, strolling through the spaceport toward the darker, cooler climes of the cantina. At least a proper cane would have some use, some practical value. Instead of this absurd stick that made squeaky sounds that equated to music. Still, he admits to himself, when the bar was full of music, spirits were raised. And when spirits were raised, so too were glasses. Full glasses meant drunk patrons, and drunk patrons meant opportunity. Distracted by these thoughts, DeJospoor does not realize as he passes inside the saloon's threshold that the smuggler and the Wookiee, eyes on the door, have drawn on him. He let his guard down for half a heartbeat. Half a heartbeat! Yet that was all it took for the smuggler to draw on him. Han Solo is the fastest draw DeJospoor has ever seen.
You wouldn't shoot a man holding a clue horn, would you? Asks DeJospoor.
That depends, says the smuggler. You wouldn't shoot a man wanted by the hut, would you?
Depends on the hut, Han, says DeJospoor. Depends on how badly he wants the man.
You're all heart, Han says.
DeJospoor cannot help but notice Han has yet to lower his blaster.
Heart suggests the warmth and kindness one reserves for friends. Yet men like us cannot afford to have friends. I consider you a mutually beneficial associate by profession, if I consider you at all.
The Wookiee barks.
No offense.
Solo answers for Chewbacca.
None taken. I hear talk I might be a marked man. Marked men mean business. That's who we are right now, poor. A bounty hunter and a bounty. A businessman and a piece of unfinished business. Unless you convince me otherwise.
I wouldn't spit on this particular hut were he burning alive before me and paying for mercy by the pound, let alone the fortune he's offering for your hide. Far be it from me to turn my back on an opportunity, but certain lines even I will not cross.
As if to underscore the banality of his intent, he pulls an awkward toot sound from the horn. Han almost laughs. For Djaspur has almost made a joke. But he didn't. So he doesn't. Han considers him. No one knows too much about Djaspur. Hunter, tracker. And they say he clawed his way out of Jabba's slave pits and never looked back. Now, Han Solo doesn't like Jabba. And the feeling at the moment surely is mutual. But even he recoils at the thought of how much hate the Sakaian must feel toward his former enslaver. Han does a quick equation in his head. Who would Djaspur want dead more? Who would Djaspur want dead first? Han puts the blaster back in its holster. Sorry, he says. Han Solo doesn't really mean it, and Djaspur doesn't really care.
Word is, you were boarded. Chewbacca growls, a confirmation. It was the safe move, Djaspur says. Live to smuggle another day, and make repaying the hut a tomorrow problem.
Han shrugs.
What else could I have done?
I am saddened, though, as if my memory serves me, among whatever else you were hauling under your floorboards, you were transferring a certain item on my behalf.
Han nods to the Wookiee. Reaching into his satchel, the Wookiee pulls out the marbled egg of a Gwayo bird. He tosses it to Djaspur, who catches it with his free hand, then admires the thing.
Boarded or not, I still know how to take care of my friends, Han says, underlining the word with his tone.
Djaspur acknowledges it, and, or Han, with a nod. Solo could have dumped the egg along with the rest of his haul, whatever contraband it was, but chose otherwise. It is a small thing, a tiny kindness, a little law broken here, an import-export regulation flaunted there, and in the face of strict legal penalty, if not actual death. Some chance to take on a mutually beneficial associate by profession, thinks Djaspur.
A taste of home,
he says by way of offering a toast, and takes a bite of the egg.
And watch your backs. The hut is gone high enough on your bounties that every boy with a blaster and an itch to make his bones will be aiming to make them with yours.
Han nods. A gesture so small, so subtle, it exists on the verge of being visible. Both know what has transpired between them, though. What a terrible business decision, thinks Djaspur, finishing the egg at his usual seat. In his usual alcove, ensconced in the darkness of the bar. For either of them. Mayo shakes Kabi by the neck, back and forth and back and forth, in Coet, a font of blackened, sour emotions, all articulated in a guttural rendering of snarls and roars. Kabi makes the noises one produces while being throttled by a homicidal abyssin.
You stole from me!
Mayo screams into Kabi's face. And the Chadrafan feels her fur blast back and gather the moisture from Mayo's breath. Kabi squeaks in violent desperation, motioning to Mayo's clenched fist around her neck.
I can't tell you anything if you keep crushing my windpipe.
Kabi tries to squeak, but instead she squeaks only,
Squeak!
Speak!
Yells Mayo, and Kabi motions more frantically to Mayo's contact with her throat. Mayo realizes what he's doing, and how it may impede upon Kabi answering his question, and lets her go. Kabi falls to the dark, cool stone of the tunnel floor.
Friend!
Kabi squeaks.
Friend! I never, never, never would I ever steal from a friend! I do not see how one could survive a place such as this without friends! My friend, the Mooftek, however.
And in a hot flash, Mayo remembers the whiff of the Mooftek from the night previous, and with both of his massive fists, pounds the wall over Kabi's head.
bits of rock dust fall on her fur.
She covers her head in case anything bigger comes down. It doesn't. When Mayo exhausts himself, he says,
I'll kill him!
Heaving with heavy, angry breath. Then something happens in his head. Kabi could swear she actually saw it happen. Harumphs Mayo. Kabi keeps watching.
Oh!
Says Mayo. Mayo then thinks for a moment, which, being Mayo, maybe stretches beyond what either of us might reasonably consider a moment.
Oh, no!
He trails off.
The drink! Hard to remember sometimes, I think.
Oh, boy,
thinks Kabi.
Maybe I owed him some money?
Mayo sinks against the wall opposite. Kabi exhales. Today she lives.
Still shouldn't have stolen from me,
he says. Then looking up to Kabi,
we should probably find the Gospoor before he finds you two and kills you.
With that, Mayo lumbers off toward daylight. Kabi follows, not so certain she'll survive the day after all.
Somehow, impossible though it may seem, there lives a creature with even worse luck than all the aforementioned combined. A Rhodian that considers himself not only a small-time loan shark in the Ascendant, but also a bounty hunter of great talents and prospects. If he has ever managed to collect a loan or a bounty as of yet, in fact, as if he had ever hunted anything successfully for that matter, no one quite could tell the tale to you with absolute certainty. What anyone knows about this particular Rhodian is, he is an idiot with a gun. A place like the Mos Eisley spaceport bloats with the number of idiots with guns prowling its corridors. So this somehow renders him even more unremarkable, unless, for whatever reason, he points it at you, in which case, who, brother? Good luck. His name? Greedo. Fits him with an ironic appropriateness, suggesting that nurture and nature traipse together, conspiring against us all in a fait accompli, hand an unlovable hand. Greedo's hands are particularly unlovable, with their long, tendril fingers and weird little suckers on the tips. And at this particular moment in our story, he pokes one sad, dangly, puckered protuberance into the chest of Liren Karn, the Bith horn player minus one horn. The musician who loves music but hates musicians. The poor sucker who cannot pay off the loan he owes to, of all beings, Greedo. Liren Karn has a secret. He planned on selling the legendary clue horn of his father Liren D'Avi that morning anyway. Liren Karn hates playing in a band. He hates his bandmates. He hates his band leader. He hates the endless, restless lifestyle of a professional itinerant where the only constant is discomfort. Never could he ever have imagined anything in the galaxy that could rob the joy of music from him. But it turns out, living the life of a musician did the trick. At least that's what he tells himself. That the horn could be converted into money he could use to repay what he owes the shifty Rhodian loan shark was only happenstance. Behind Greedo stands the pig-nosed man and the walrus-faced man that everyone, save Greedo, knows to avoid. They project a sense of actual menace that the always this side of desperate Greedo lacks, no matter how hard he tries.
Payday, Biff.
Greedo purr gargles in his native tongue.
I don't have it. Next week?
Asks Liren Karn, as if none of this would be remarkable or create any need for raised tones and physical violence. As far as Liren Karn can figure, there is no way around it. Greedo wants a thing he simply does not have. All Liren Karn could do would be to somehow figure out how to acquire the money he owes that doesn't involve pawning his father's instrument, which he no longer possesses. Greedo pokes him harder, managing to push Liren Karn into the wall.
And why should I provide you clemency? Why should I show you mercy? A debt is a debt. The terms were that I would be paid in full by you today.
I cannot, Greedo, for I literally have no...
He turns his pockets inside out to show the Rodian.
Money at all. I was robbed last night, you see, and...
Greedo yelps in frustration. He gets closer.
I shall only raise your interest rate to 35% and choose to let you live,
he hisses.
You are very lucky.
I do not feel very lucky,
Liren Karn says.
Well, you are, because today is the day Greedo levels up. And I don't have that time to chase broke little hustlers like you up and down the spaceport.
The pig-nosed man and the walrus-faced man share a smug chuckle. The sound of two bullies about to remove the pocket change from an unknowing and smaller child. Liren Karn can't help but laugh at the idea of a hopeless case like Greedo belonging to the same class of violent criminal as these two. And yet, by association, Liren Karn can only assume this is the reputation the Rodian wishes to cultivate. This is the kind of thing to which Greedo aspires. These two chuckling, violent morons radiate Greedo's dream vibe. Greedo tugs at his blaster, but it catches in its holster, and needing a second hand to extract the thing... The maneuver, so incompetent in its perfect Greedoian absurdity, strikes Liren Karn as laughable. And thus he laughs again, rather than doing what any sensible creature would do when an idiot attempts to draw a weapon on them only for the thing to get stuck, which is run. The laughter only makes things worse. Before Liren Karn knows it, Greedo pushes the unstuck blaster into his chest, keeping the bith at bay in place against the wall. The gun shivers in Greedo's hand, quivering in anticipation of firing.
Today, I capture or kill the most wanted man on Tatooine. Today, I make my name in the court of Jabba the Great. Today, I collect my first fortune.
Every time he says today, he jabs the pistol harder into Liren Karn's already concave chest in a way impossible to consider anything other than hostile. Liren Karn cannot stop looking at the gun and snickering. It all feels so remote and surreal.
Stop it!
Greedo shouts, poking the gun into him one last time for emphasis. Liren Karn, actually hurt and actually annoyed now, shoves Greedo's gun hand out of his way, as if to say, knock it off! And he slaps it to the side, which sends the lithe little green sylph back into the pig-nosed man. The walrus-faced man chugs like a motor igniting, and rams the bith back into the wall, hard, keeping his massive left arm pressed under Liren Karn's chin. And at long last, fear ignites inside Liren Karn, and floods through his body all at once. Lightning and fire and panic.
Warp, 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 warp,
orps the walrus-faced man.
12 systems!
Pig-nosed man corrects. Liren Karn feels throttled by genuine, panic-inducing fight-or-flight fear now. Madness radiates off these two, and Greedo. Greedo wears bad luck around him like a cloud of fart, like ambient surface radiation, like a haunting aura of actual garbage. Mere proximity guaranteed his bad luck would contaminate you too, and closer to now than later. Maybe the pig-nosed man and the walrus-faced man don't know, but Liren Karn knows, and Liren Karn now finally wants to run, but cannot.
All right,
says Greedo, touching the walrus-faced man, who frees Liren Karn from the wall.
Silence then. Karn looks from one to the other, and they all stare at him. The silence holds. And holds.
Can I have until next week, then?
Asks Liren Karn. Greedo holsters his pistol once more, and mutters in the affirmative. Karn sees, along the length of the barrel of the thing, a little wisp of a prayer Greedo has scratched into its gunmetal surface. The word solo. Desperate. Desperate and crazy.
As far as the Mooftak can tell, the pig-nosed man, called Dr. Evazan to his pig-nosed face, but never in his absence, has no friends. Except for the walrus-faced man, called Pondababa. And same, and even so, they probably don't like each other very much. They have only managed to not kill each other yet, because it's 50-50 how a fight would go down between them. A pair of psychotically entangled parasites. The pig-nosed man lives life in a constant state of pain and anger. No one quite knew what exactly Evazan did to himself, or why, but it mangled his face, split his nose, and made him quite impossible to deal with rationally. To mitigate the perpetual agony his wounds cause him, the mad doctor relies on a constant, alternating barrage of narcotics and physical violence. And a man with no friends except for a walrus-faced man has great difficulties finding the first, and far too much ease finding the second. The result of the cycle is this. No one wants to sell Dr. Evazan his drugs, because Dr. Evazan tends to ward dumb and dangerous behavior no matter what level of illicit substances flow through him. This life will not end well for the doctor. The Mooftak hustles too hard to hold his hose shut at such an opportunity. He worked himself into a semi-regular arrangement as an intermediary. Evazan gives the Mooftak a cool 1,000, and less his danger surcharge and breaking the law expenditure, the Mooftak pays the balance to the smuggler, who, knowing better than to ask why or who for of his customers, converts the money into the anodyne chemical compounds the good doctor seeks. Minus his own not inconsiderable shipping and handling charges, then delivers them to the Mooftak, who delivers them to the doctor, and hopes this will not be the time their arrangement gets him killed.
I had to drop my cargo, pal. Sorry, says Han Solo. Imperial interference.
He shrugs. Nothing could have been done then. Nothing can be done now. The Mooftak might as well yell at the sun. Either sun. It won't help.
What?
The Mooftak panicked tweets.
My client. I took his money. You took his money. Then upon delivery, he paid me a completion bonus and a hazard stipend, as per our agreement. You owe me his money! You owe me my money that he will not pay me now, as I will not provide him with the goods and services he requires. What are we going to do about this, Solo?
Solo turns to the Wookiee, who barks and growls and snorts a pigeon translation.
Well, Solo says, nothing. Unless you want to take it up with the Empire, we lose this round.
This does not help calm the Mooftak.
Everybody loses sometimes. Even me.
But I lose every time!
The Mooftak bleats out, banging his big furry fists on the table. The Wookiee puts his bigger, furrier fists on the table, too. Because some things you can say without saying anything sometimes, even if you can't say anything at all. The Mooftak inhales, and then exhales. The temperature of the table lowers as quickly as it rose. The Mooftak imagines Evazan doing to his face what was done to his own. He imagines Pondababa shoving all of his eyes in, all at once. He imagines them both coming upon Kabi, helpless and alone without the Mooftak's protection, blind in the daylight, dying of heat, and then...
than dying of them.
He turns to Chewbacca.
Could I implore you at least this? Come with me as I explain to my client our shared predicament in the hope that his fury... And make no mistake, there will be great fury. It might find itself diminished by the sheer majesty of your great physical presence.
The Wookiee snorts. He probably means yes? Stop me if you've heard this one before. A Jadrafan, a Bith, a Sakaian, an Abyssin, an Aqualish, a human, a Rodian, a Wookiee, another human, and a Mooftak walk into a bar. All of them trying to rip one another off at best, and kill one another at worst. More or less. The Mooftak freezes. Every head at his usual table turns to him. Some faces look happy, others furious. Only the Sakaian speaks.
Come, friend, join us.
Not the Mooftak's first choice. He finds the reception awaiting him at the usual table a complicated array of responses. No one, it would seem, feels terribly happy he has come. Except Copy, of course, who figures her odds of dying in the near future have dropped at least a little bit. The Joss Poor gets up, as does Liren Karn, ensuring that the Mooftak cannot leave the table with any great ease.
Quite a day you've had.
I'm doomed,
the Mooftak says.
Rightfully so,
shouts Mayo.
Gentlemen, keep your heads, says the Joss Poor.
Mayo, I took from you a pawnable thing of value to reimburse what you owed me in losses. It was not mine to take, but I was owed.
Hissing now through gritted teeth, hoping it reduces his volume, Mayo leans over.
It was not yours to take.
I just...
The Mooftak looks around to his compatriots.
Did I not just say... Yes, Mayo, yes. It was not mine to take. In my defense, I collected on a debt...
I might have had the money. You don't know.
The Mooftak honestly hadn't considered this.
Did you have the money?
Mayo, a terrible liar, lies.
Maybe.
Can we address perhaps a larger point, Mayo?
Says Liren Karn, turning his fury on the furious one.
In that I... in my cups, made a foolish decision, and you chose to exploit it.
Profit from it, you mean?
Mayo says and laughs. He looks to the others to join in, yet they do not. The ugly truth among them all finds its place at the table now, too. The fragility of their civility to one another, radiant in the dank alcove of their booth.
I am particularly doomed,
the Mooftak says.
Today especially.
Sounds of agreement to varying degrees and with varying levels of enthusiasm issue forth from his cohort.
Why today of all days? Why not yesterday? Why not tomorrow?
Solo wet his pants at the sight of an Imperial garbage barge and dropped cargo. Some of that cargo was mine. Owed to someone else. And now they're going to kill me. And if they don't, they're not paying the balance owed. Which means someone else will kill me. As I find myself financially embarrassed at the moment, and direly in need of some liquidity.
The Mooftak squirps, motioning to Mayo and Liren Karn as he does. The subtext being to pay these gentles back what they are owed, even though, strictly speaking, none of them are owed anything. Not really.
All of which is to say, I have no idea how to resolve the issue of the horn, or how to reimburse those who demand and deserve adequate recompense.
He dropped your cargo, DeJospor says. And yet he kept mine. Had Solo been searched, and searched thoroughly by these admirals of the Imperial Refuse Fleet, possession of the cargo he brought me would have brought him a death sentence. And yet,
DeJospor lets the notion hang in the space among them. The Muftak looks to the ceiling, dingy and stained, and encrusted with filth generations old, and bleats a noise that sounds, oddly enough, as if it came from the clue horn that started this whole mess.
What's your point? Han Solo likes you better than me? You have more friends than me? Fine, great. You are a beloved figure to DeJospor. I'm already dead. I just don't know it yet.
I'm merely intrigued. Solo made a choice. Perhaps not a moral choice, but an ethical one.
DeJospor says in response,
perhaps he considers me a threat, so he decided not to drop my contraband. Perhaps he considers you a... well, you're the Muftak.
The Muftak bangs his head on the table.
You're not a killer, is my point. Maybe the medications you provide Dr. Evazan...
The Muftak snaps his head up.
That arrangement was supposed to be discreet.
Everybody knows.
Sorry.
Those at the table agree, demure as they can manage, but agreeing all the same. The Muftak drops his shoulders a little more, thoroughly and totally defeated. As bad a drug dealer as he is a card player, a money haver, a life liver.
One moment, says Liren Karn. You're not giving him narcotics now, are you? Today?
No, because Solo dropped cargo. I have nothing to give.
Clicks the Muftak.
Why?
Greedo the Rodian is making a play for Solo. Ponda Baba and Evazan are backing it. I thought for a moment of an Evazan blitz to the gills, who would make a violent situation only more violent, and was relieved he shall be without. Though saying it out loud, I'm not so certain. Which Evazan is better, medicated or not?
I need a drink,
says Kabi, and she escapes under the table to approach the bar.
I am going to die,
the Muftak says.
Well then, Muftak, on the precipice of death, what sort of creature shall you be? One who values friends or profit? By which code have you lived?
The Muftak wiggles his wee trunk back and forth. He looks around the bar. He sees all sorts. Friends, fiends, foes, financial prospects, and liabilities. All of whom would just as soon gut him and rob him blind as reach down to help him, he is sure. And then, as always, he sees the best part of a place like Mos Eisley, and is filled with a new hope. A teenage girl enters, looking around, eyes wide as dying stars, skin radiant with the flush of youth. The Muftak knows she's never been here before, because she tries bringing her golden interpreter droid in with her. An old man that should know better follows.
The Muftak looks at this girl and tries to imagine how much money she and her ancient father could have between them. How much he could swindle or steal. The prospect of fresh work, of a new project, a new mark excites him.
The Muftak looks to Liren Karn.
Liren Karn, I never should have accepted your father's horn from Mayo.
banging the table in protest, Mayo turns...
Accepted!